Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Long Story Short, the podcast about storytelling and connection, where we interview marketers and entrepreneurs to hear the stories they tell about their brands. I'm Jeff.
And I'm Sophia. This is a podcast by humans for humans who also happen to be marketers. On this week's show, our guest is Scott Brinker.
Scott has been analyzing marketing technology and its impact on marketing organizations for more than a decade. He writes the chiefmartech.com blog and serves as the program chair of the MarTech conference series. He serves as vice president of platform ecosystem at HubSpot, helping to grow and nurture the company's community of technology partners. And he authored the best-selling book, Hacking Marketing, about adapting software management practices such as agile methodologies to marketing teams. Previously, he was the co-founder and CTO of Ion Interactive. He holds degrees in computer science from Columbia University and Harvard University, and an MBA from MIT. Connect with him on Twitter at Chief Martech.
Ever wish you could talk to Scott and hear his advice to further your career? Well, you can hear his biggest tip and more in this week's episode. We got to hear everything from what 2030 will be like to Scott's biggest marketing mistake.
It was such a treat to have Scott on the podcast. He is the person for all things related to Martech, and he clearly has an impact across so many different facets of the industry. So without further ado, please enjoy our conversation with Scott Brinker. So Scott, welcome to the podcast. Thanks for being on.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So I want to start with this. I mean, you wear a lot of hats, as we just talked about, between HubSpot, the blog, the MarTech conference, your book, and all sorts of speaking engagements, but they're all really interconnected in some way or another. So can you tell us about sort of those things and how you really utilize sort of the crossover between them?
Yeah, I mean, the common theme is it's all MarTech all the time. Right. What do you do in the morning, MarTech? What do you do at night, MarTech? Professionally, before I joined HubSpot, I was a co-founder of a SaaS company that created technology for marketers. When I sold that company, I joined HubSpot to help them with, their app ecosystem, it's now more than a marketing platform, but, we're renowned for that. So I've always really had a hand in how the technology comes together to enable what marketers can do. But at the same time, yeah, the stuff I've done with, the blog, and then that led to the conference and, all these other things, is actually much more of a fascination of not so much really the technology, but how are marketing teams and marketers as professionals, like how are we evolving, our discipline, our organizations, with this technology? That's the stuff that in some ways I find the most fascinating aspect of this. The two definitely feed each other.
That's great.
So as we talked about you wearing a bunch of different hats, also your professional journey began a little bit earlier maybe than some other people's would have. So we just want to hear starting from then, and then you talked about the evolution of the industry, but how has the evolution of your career journey played into where you are now?
Yeah. Wow. Okay. So digging back in the archives. When I was
as far back as you're willing to go,
I will date myself. But when I was a teenager, right before the internet, the web really took off, there were these things called bulletin board systems that, people would dial into with their modems. It was a little bit of a subculture before the web took off. And so I started as a teenager actually writing multiplayer games, for that community that turned into a bit of a little business. Now that was back in the days when getting your own little business as a teenager was novel. Ever since Zuckerberg launched Facebook out of his dorm room, if you're not going to build a multi-billion dollar business by the time you're 20, then yeah.
Who are you?
What you did was cute. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, that's nice. It always fascinated me, this interplay of, let's face it, the past 30, 40 years have been, this really incredible evolution of just technology creating net new kinds of businesses. They used to always say the jobs your children will have will be jobs that didn't even exist, right, when you were growing up. That's true, right? I mean, it's an influencer marketing program manager, for instance. Anyway, so that kind of got me down this career of like building things sort of on the edge of, you know, technology, with communications. But then, being an engineer, it's one thing to build a piece of software, but it turns out, unfortunately, if you build it, they don't necessarily come. That you actually have to like market this stuff. Imagine that. Mm-hmm. So I started to market, my own software. I actually became just really fascinated with the dynamics of marketing. And then over the years, I ran a web development agency. We would be hired by the marketing org. My team on the technology side would bridge the gap to their IT team. That was actually the genesis of the Chief MarTech blog, was, doing this shuttle diplomacy between marketing and IT a decade or so ago. It was fascinating to see how that collaboration, emerged from opposite ends,
right,
of the career spectrum. And then it kind of grew from there into, SaaS apps, and now what I do at HubSpot of helping other people who are creating SaaS apps build on top of a platform.
That's great. So you mentioned a few times now the blog that you started. We just want to hear a little bit more about what within your career journey led you to want to start a blog, how you got there.
Yeah, it seemed like the in thing to do. It's funny. I remember starting the blog just because, as I was having these conversations about how to bridge, the world of marketing professionals and the world of, IT and software professionals, it seemed like, okay, well, let's put some of these thoughts down somewhere. And, blogs were, a thing. To be completely transparent here, I launched it in 2008, and I'd say easily for the first 3 years, if I had 50 people who visited the blog, that must have been a ton. In fact, I was thrilled. I was like, oh my God, we got 50 visitors. They're on fire.
And look, one's halfway across the world.
And to be honest, I enjoyed it mostly because, two things. One is just the process of, writing things down. I've always found it's just helpful for myself to just like, mm-hmm, clarify. Like if you can explain something to, yep, someone else, it forces you to, get pretty clear in your own head. Like, all right, well, what is this story? Mm-hmm. And then even when it was only like, 50 people or so, a month coming to the blog, it was 50 people or so who kind of were very interested in the same thing. And to start to develop that early sense of community of like, oh yeah, you're seeing these same patterns, where you work, and oh, how did you deal with this situation? And then like, they're like, oh, and I know 10 other people, who have been wrestling with that. And so watching those communities like emerge from their very nascent stage, that was a thrilling time long before the blog had any, visibility on the, larger marketing scene.
No, I really appreciate your comments about writing. I know as a writer myself, one thing I always think about is like the information in your head is only as good as however you communicate that to everyone else. Otherwise, it's just staying in your head and it's not going anywhere else. So I think the whole way that you can drive community through communicating your thoughts and doing it in a concise and clear way is so essential. So I really appreciate that and how that's stuck with you, even though you started in 08 as a trendy blogger. Now you're still doing it, and hopefully more than 50 people are now. We think there's more than 50 on your site. So
yeah, it might be up to 100 now, which is awesome, like doubling in 10 years. Like,
well, you found two of them right here. So
awesome. Okay.
So we know you also have the name of the blog is chiefmartech.com, but MarTech, MARTEC. So we know you have a funny story there behind how that came to be. We would love if you would share that. It's one of your roadblocks maybe in your career development.
Slightly embarrassing, but yeah, I mean, all right. So like I said, yeah, I was launching the blog because you had these two communities coming together, marketing and tech. And so I was looking for, marketing technologist, chief marketing technologist is a really long domain name. So I was looking for something shorter. And I think someone had the domain martech with an h.com, but I mean, and I think it was like something weird. It's actually like a marine technology company, like Mar, like marine. Anyway, right? At the time, right? I mean, you know, one of the things in the marketing profession is people always talked about Marcom, M-A-R-C-O-M, you know, is like, oh, well, this is the discipline of Marcom, you know, marketing and communications. And so I'm like, oh, great. Well, then I guess marketing and technology would be martech. And if com is just three letters, I guess tech can just have three letters. So, of course, I've now, you know, been stuck with that brand for 12 years. So thank you for bringing that up. Yeah,
of course. It's all about telling the story, right? I mean, if that's the worst thing that happens in your career, I say you're doing a pretty good job. So
fair enough.
So we want to go from there. Is we're back in 2008, and I want to spin us forward, and I'm going to go even past. I'm going to blow right past 2020, as I think a lot of people would want to do, and I want to go. I want to go straight to 2030. How about that? So,
all right,
what I've seen most recently from your blog and from are some of the MarTech predictions around 2030. And one of the things I found most fascinating that I'd love to get your take on is the idea, and it makes a ton of sense when you think about it, is that technology is almost always going to evolve faster than organizations and fundamentally people can. And so I think, and to the way you talk about the technology enabling the people, I'm curious from your perspective, how do you see the people kind of keeping up with the evolution of technology over the next 10 years and beyond?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's challenging. I mean, I think there is more happening in the world than, I mean, even just in like, you know, the world of marketing, there's more happening than any one person could like ever stay on top of, you know, even if you like multiplied, you know, cloned yourself, you know, 1,000 right. times over. You know, and so I think at some level, you just have to accept that is like, all right, you know, not going to keep up with all of it. What matters is you are continually learning. You know, you are continually like advancing your skills and your perspective, you know, and hopefully, you know, following the things that are most relevant to what you're doing professionally, but also, you know, a little bit of following your passion. You know, I think marketing, any of these creative professions, you know, the more you can align what you're pursuing with something you're genuinely passionate about, it just taps, you know, I think a lot of imagination and innovation. That's arguably the most valuable thing, you know, in marketing. I think the other thing, though, that is maybe starting to work in our favor is for a long time, every time there was new technology, it was entirely on us to figure out how to use it, you know, like manually, like pull the levers yep. and turn the knobs. But now this new wave of technology where we're increasingly seeing these, you know, AI related, you know, agents mm-hmm. that are starting to take on more things that they can do for us. You know, that's actually, I'm optimistic that starts to at least, if not completely turn the tide, you know, at least rein it in a bit of like, okay, listen, I don't need to know all the details of like a statistical model to like run this data science, you know, program to like identify propensity for churn, you know, within a particular customer segment. If I have a machine learning tool that I trust and I've configured it the right way and I'm feeding it the right data, you know, actually, it starts to do a lot of work for me, and then I get to leverage the output of that, you know, to, you know, make sort of higher level strategic decisions and integrate that into the rest of things that are happening. So I think you're starting to see more and more examples now where some of these AI tools are going to help us tame some mm-hmm. of the new technology as well as being the new technology itself.
No, that's interesting. And especially obviously in a field as sort of creatively driven as marketing, to your point, you know, around the technology can continue to evolve, but so making it more approachable for people and making it easier for them to get into sort of getting the value out of that technology is it sounds like, you know, really what the next couple of years will look like.
Yeah, I think there's also a really nice trend, you know, for a long time, software development was, let's see here. I don't want to, you know, say anything bad against my early software colleagues, but, you know, the user experience of a lot of software generally sucked. And one of the things that, you know, we've seen in software movement, particularly over these past 5 years, is increasingly UX has become a competitive differentiator that people are realizing it's not just about the raw functionality. It's about how easy do I make it for people to tap into that? And so, you look at current state of the art SaaS products and they are just so much easier to use than the predecessors. So I think that's also a trend that hopefully helps us keep up with some of these new capabilities.
Yeah, as for my, me personally, as an analyst, you know, by trade, you know, where I started, I was a SaaS programmer. I'm a SaaS certified base SaaS programmer, and now they have all the drag and drop and the GUI functionality. So now nobody needs to learn sort of the languages that I had to, or that I'm sure you did as well, right? So.
I had to program an assembly language.
That's right.
Uphill, both ways. Yeah.
That's right. But that's why I love, you know, sort of the idea to your point around like the no code stuff, right? Like the rise of the no code and making it a lot more approachable. I think you've started to see that, but I really like the, you know, sort of the idea that this will be, you know, really, you know, much more household needs to be, you know, sort of part of it. It's a table, sort of table stakes in 2030.
Yeah. And it's not, I mean, I guess, when people hear the phrase no code, they think about, you know, for like programming and apps, right? Oh, programming, but without the code. And there's certainly a lot of that. But I think I even, maybe another way to phrase it is almost talking about these citizen creators, this idea that, okay, well, it's not just for, you know, programming apps. It's for like, you know, doing graphic design. It's for doing data analysis. It's for, you know, like editing podcasts or producing videos. It's like all these tools that sort of bottle in the capabilities of experts in a way that make it accessible for the non-experts. I mean, you can't do everything the experts can do. But yeah, if you can do like a bunch of stuff that frankly, you wouldn't have been able to, you know, justify paying an expert for, you know, that little thing anyway, and now to kind of get it out of the box, I mean, yeah, that's incredible.
Yeah, that's great. And so I want to talk about a topic that's always near and dear to my heart, and that's data. So I love the analogy you use in the piece around data not being the new oil, but the new oil paint. And we've seen this consistently over the last couple of years in working with marketers and marketing leaders directly is that, you know, they say sort of universally their number one priority is how do we attribute revenue back to marketing activities, and what's their number one challenge? Well, attributing, right? So it's their number one priority and their number one challenge are one and the same, which is all around attribution. So what are your thoughts in terms of how some of the sort of the advancement in technology and in, you know, looking towards 2030, how technology will better enable attribution and really being able to kind of prove the value that marketing is creating for organizations?
Yeah, well, definitely. There's been great progress on both. There's kind of two pieces to attribution. There's like the algorithm that's, you know, doing the calculations. But there's been some definitely advancement in, you know, the algorithms that people are applying to this. But really, the big factor comes down to, are you feeding the right data into that algorithm? And the right data is a function of things like, is it clean data? Is it quality? Mm-hmm. Is it complete, right? Like if I'm only feeding in data, you know, that comes from visits to my website, you know, but I've got a whole call center that's running other, you know, activities, I don't connect the dots, I can have an attribution model that, 100% of this value goes to the website. Oh, all right, awesome. Right. It's disconnected from reality. We're making incredible progress now on getting all this data connected. I think it's interesting that, you know, there's two pieces to this. So attribution models, particularly if you're in like B2B or if you're in businesses with, you know, like long sales cycles or long customer journey, customer value relationships, the attribution insight is phenomenal, but it takes time to reveal itself, which is good. But then, you know, I think if you pair that with sort of, you know, within particular stages of that journey, the ability to just more fluidly run experiments, which is, again, just another feature that the digital world gives us of, I mean, a lot of the software makes it really easy to run experiments. What's held back a lot of companies isn't the technical barrier there. It's that it's still here in 2020, a bit of a novelty for a bunch of people think like, oh, I don't just have to do one version of this, you know, and take my best guess. Like, I could actually have a couple hypotheses and I could try this one, I could try that one. And it's not that much more overhead to do the experimentation, but the way in which it gives you that, you know, greater range of opportunity to find success and learn from it. I'm hoping by the time we get to 2030, experimentation is just going to be like a natural part of, you know, how every marketer professional runs their day.
I love that. And I love the idea. And to me, and I've said that sort of throughout my career, is that I don't want to pretend to have all the answers, but I know how we can test into them, right? So how can you develop experiments to be able to build into that? And so to almost have, I don't want to say less ownership over these things, but not to treat them as precious, you know, as precious as maybe you do, is saying, okay, this copy or this creative or this email template, or it's like, no, let's come up with three options and let's let the market sort of do the, you know, sort of the do the deciding for us.
One of my favorite quotes of all time is the Nobel Prize winning chemist, Linus Pauling, you know, who was asked like, well, how do you, because he like, man, invented all this amazing stuff. And people ask like, how do you come up with all of these amazing ideas? And his answer was like, oh, well, the key to having, you know, a lot of amazing ideas is to come up with way more ideas, most of which suck, you know, but
that's
you
right.
keep trying
right.
all these things by just pure probability. Mm-hmm. You're going to run into one or two that are good somewhere along
yeah.
the line. I'm paraphrasing.
But. No, I love that. I love that. So let me add, one thing you mentioned is around, you know, sort of the idea of some of the AI, and you talked a little bit about with some of the attribution modeling specifically, and in analytics, one of the big issues that any of these things are going to run into is garbage in, garbage out, right? So it's the model and sort of the black box that is now more and more sort of shrouded in mystery, since it's, you know, becoming less and less, you know, as much that somebody needs to sort of manually impact it. That is only as good as what goes into it. And so I see this very often, as a lot of times companies will end up getting the right answers to the wrong questions is the way I say it. But I'm curious into how you can see some of this technology, like how can some of the technology become smarter about knowing your data is incomplete or your data is biased, or, you know, some of the things that, you know, maybe a human wouldn't necessarily immediately recognize. And then they'd have this beautiful model that is based on, you know, something that's maybe a misrepresented view of the world.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's we've definitely run into that. But again, this is the great thing about technology innovation is, you know, the moment a technology comes, solves one problem, but in the process creates another, it's usually not too long until someone then comes up with a technology to help solve that problem, and it goes on. And so, like, you know, if you do a little bit of poking around on like IBM, for instance, there's a number of companies doing this, but like IBM has a practice they've really built out, you know, for all these tools that their entire purpose in life is to look at these machine learning models and like identify bias, you know, like identify, you know, signals that would indicate that, hey, there's some sort of error or inconsistency. And I can't remember the names of them, but I feel like I've seen at least two or three funding announcements mm-hmm. in the past couple of weeks of companies entirely focused on just like, okay, well, this is a tool, you add this to your machine learning stack. And what it does is it looks at what your other tools are doing, and it helps identify, you know, when there's, you know, disturbances in the forest. I think it is a genuine problem. I'm glad to see some technology mm-hmm. starting to come to help with it. But it's also a thing that, yeah, I mean, as executives, as marketers, as people who aren't necessarily data scientists, I think we need to at least start to embed into our, you know, thinking the recognition that, wow, bias and error in model and error in data. I mean, these are the big problems we can face in an AI machine learning based, you know, environment. So
that's great. And so one of the major categories you cover in the 2030 piece is around the growth of platforms, networks, and marketplaces. And, you know, just kind of curious from your role, but specifically, like, how does HubSpot, you know, really kind of fit into that vision, and how do they help to build that into their future as well?
Yeah, I mean, so HubSpot definitely is in all of those categories, right? We have a platform that people can build on. You know, we increasingly have a network of, you know, solution partners and, you know, app partners. And then, yeah, we've created marketplaces that allow, you know, the producers of these apps and solutions to connect with consumers who want to, you know, purchase them. But yeah, part of why I came up with that is, well, you know, that's kind of like the software company version of what those things look like. I kind of feel like we see these patterns just appearing everywhere, you know, in marketing today. I mean, like if you're building your own online community, you know, if you're creating internally some sort of, like brand foundation, you know, kit that then allows people to like, you know, run highly customized campaigns on top of that, but still be, you know, within the, you know, guardrails, you know, that you've governed centrally, you know, that's kind of like a platform model for creative. You know, the networks we use like Slack, I mean, we don't think about it this way, but Slack has essentially created, you know, all sorts of cool network dynamics, you know, within companies and, you know, even across companies now with, partners or customers getting engaged in these channels too. And so, I don't know, I feel like the common thread among all of these is platforms, networks, and marketplaces allow you to take a very large group of people and allow them to, on one hand, do a lot of independent activity, you know, to maximize productivity and maximize innovation, but at the same time, do it around enough of a centralized set of principles or, you know, data models or things like this, that, yeah, these things aren't all like floating off completely independent of each other. They all feed back into something that helps, you know, with, I guess, they call it network dynamics, right? So there it's at play.
That's great. And speaking of which, I mean, our podcast at its core is really about connection. And so we love sort of the intentional and unintentional collisions of ideas that happen when people come together. And so what have you seen specifically from switching gears a little bit on the MarTech conference in terms of helping some of these ideas and the progress really spread across the industry?
Yeah, the conference is definitely a really special a special inflection point in this industry. I remember when we launched the first one in 2014, you know, it was still right on that edge of like, you know, if you talk to someone and said like, oh yeah, I'm a marketing technologist. Like, yeah, I work in marketing, but I do the technology. You get these looks of like, what? You know? it just like didn't compute, like, you know, yeah, I guess you're doing that, but that's not like a real profession, right? And I think a lot of people who were in those roles, you know, they felt a bit like the odd person out. They knew what they were doing was good, but yeah, there wasn't a lot of like recognition or even camaraderie there. And so that very first MarTech conference where like all of a sudden, like, you know, hundreds of these folks are able to get together in the same room and be like, oh yeah, you get this. Yes, yep. Yes, this is a real thing. Like, oh yeah, you know, it was such a like awakening. And for me, that was amazing. You know, and so I think the conference, you know, sort of like rode those, you know, early years of this community, just even discovering each other and developing a sense of identity. You know, so now, like, yeah, you look around on, you know, like Twitter or something, and, you know, people have like, you know, MarTech and, you know, marketing technologist in their profile. It's great that's gotten out such public acceptance. But yeah, 5-6 years ago, that just, it just wasn't even in the lexicon of like, what's the marketing industry think about? Yeah, so.
That's great.
So we've talked about a broad array of different success stories, maybe some beyond the blog of like roadblocks, like we said, but beyond that, general success stories within you, within the industry. We're just really curious, personally or professionally, how you define success. What does success mean to you? Of course, that's an ever evolving definition, but in your brain of Scott Brinker, how do you conceptualize success?
Oh, wow. Well, if I can, you know, tell the dad joke on Twitter and get at least 5 likes on it, I consider that to be like a really excellent day.
You're doing great then.
Yeah. Okay. No, I'm in my element. My daughter will unfortunately attest to. You know, I think the one thing I've really been incredibly grateful for is having the opportunities to create. I think that's what this comes down to, is to explore new things. I'm starting to sound like a Star Trek explorer, brave new worlds, and, you know, uncharted, whatever. Anyway, but it's like, you know, I think if I think about like what would be a terrible job for me, would be something where it's like, okay, this is the procedure, this is what you do, It always works this way. Do it every day for the next 20 years. I just, you know, and my I say this with some acknowledgement that there's still a lot of jobs in our world that, you know, sort of fit that profile. And I always, I have a lot of empathy for just feeling like, man, like if we could just get more people to be in a position where the rote elements, you know, of things become less of where we're applying our human time and talent, you know, and open up more opportunities, you know, for us to create, to do the human things, you know, that give meaning, you know, to life. So this turned really philosophical all of a sudden. Anyway, to me, the ability to do that sort of work and have somebody like also pay me to like cover the mortgage as part of that, like, okay, that's success. That's awesome. Thank you.
That's amazing. I mean, one thing Jeff and I always say is before anything else, you're a human, you know, and if you can, recognize that and have a prosperous career, you know, you've done well. So we're well aligned there. But another thing you mentioned in that answer is that your day to day is not the same, right? It's constantly changing. And that's part of the beauty, but can also make it hard for some people who want to break into the industry. So looking back a little bit, one thing we want to know is what, from your perspective now, what would you share? What advice would you give to someone who is trying to start out in this industry or where you were starting out? What would you have wanted to know?
Yeah, well, I mean, you could actually make the argument that because things are changing so fast, you could argue that actually people breaking in, you know, the people who are already there don't necessarily have a tremendous advantage over them, right? Because if the playing field keeps changing, it's like whenever you show up and you get engaged, like, all right, you know, you're on more of a level playing field than, you know, might have been the case in a more stable, you know, less quickly changing, you know, profession. I think the most important thing is to actually do this stuff hands-on, you know. And so one of the things I always recommend, you know, like when people have a particular job, they're starting out in marketing, is first encourage them to volunteer for other projects inside the company. Anything that, you know, gives you a chance to just, again, try new things, you know, experiment. It's great. And if you can't find anyone who's willing to give you those things in your current job, you know, then like go home and like start a blog, start a little, you know, business on Shopify or something like this. Not necessarily because, oh yeah, I'm going to be a blogger professionally, or I'm going to be a e-commerce merchant. Although who knows, maybe you will. But because by having those things where you can say, oh, okay, well, I've got my own little Shopify store. It doesn't do a lot of revenue, but I'm like constantly getting to experiment, like, oh, well, how do I run campaigns? And how do I think of bringing customers back? And like, oh, what happens when I, you know, embed this capability on the site? And how does this affect me in the search? And it just, to have the ability to like play with this stuff hands-on, I think it just gives you an enormous advantage lean into that.
Yeah.
That's great. One thing I just want to say, because I think it's really fascinating, is that, you know, I've even heard you say this about yourself, Scott, that you sort of live on the intersection of technology platforms, ecosystems, strategy, and operations. But what kind of comes across to me so clearly is really it's how all of that enables the human side of things, right? Like enables the humans to do the work that they do. And so I think that's fascinating to see how, you know, how technical some of your work is, but really at its essence, it's really about how do you then turn the humans into the creators, right? So I think that's great.
I mean, the whole digital world is, it's definitely a mixed bag. Like it's created all sorts of challenges and problems for us that even in 2020, the list is long, but at the same time, because the dynamics are so different, I also feel like it sometimes gives us some of the tools to address these new problems as well, too. I mean, again, like, you know, the classic example is, you've got all this technology changing very quickly. So how do software companies keep up? Well, one of the ways they keep up is if they become, you know, a platform with an open ecosystem, then it's not just about them having to keep up with everything themselves, but you start to now get this connected community of creators around that. And as things change, there is always some creator somewhere in the ecosystem that's on top of that and keeps up with it. And so those ecosystem dynamics actually help us survive in an environment where, the just pace of change is, thundering upon us.
Yep. That's great. And so before we let you go, just a couple things we like to ask all of our guests here. So the first one is, what resources would you recommend to our audience? Books, blogs, podcasts, anything else like that?
Oh, wow. I was actually, so this is somewhat random, but I'm just rereading a book that I forgot how much I love. It's a book called Anti-Fragility by Nassim Nicholas Taleb, the guy who did Fooled by Randomness, Black Swan. And one of the things I love about the concept of anti-fragility is, like, we're so used to thinking about systems as being these fragile things that, oh my goodness, this shock happens and the system breaks, And the whole thesis of Taleb's book on anti-fragility is, there's actually a way to create systems that they don't get harmed by change, that actually change strengthens them. Right. In fact, actually, ecosystems are like a great example of that. Exactly as we said, it's like, because you've got this ecosystem, as change happens, it doesn't destroy the product. What it does is, because you have now somewhere in the ecosystem people who will be able to react to that and build on it quickly, it actually strengthens the overall platform and ecosystem that change was happening. So again, not the easiest thing in the world to always line that up, but I think, that sort of thinking is, the way we harness these digital forces that we have unleashed upon ourselves.
That's great. And then finally, where can people find you and your work on the internet and social media?
Well, I'm Chief Martech without the H at the end. And also at Chief Martech without the H on Twitter. So yeah, happy to engage and ask me about my brand sometime.
Perfect.
How about you have an H?
Yeah.
It's called your H.
Well, Scott, thank you so much for this. This is really great. We really appreciate having you on. Thanks for your time and thanks for sharing your story with us.
Thank you so much for having me. Have a great day.
Thanks, Scott. That was a great conversation with Scott. And from as much as I love reading his stuff on MarTech, I get out even more from talking to him directly. And now it's time for Footnotes with Sophia.
Footnotes is where we expand on portions of the discussion that we wanted to learn more about and share with you. So the first thing, Jeff, is that you mention marketing companies' number one problem and priority is attribution. I just was wondering if you could expand a little more on that.
Yeah, we had done some work, some survey work with a couple different clients, and that came out of senior level marketers telling us going into 2020 and in 2021, we had two separate questions. One was around what their biggest pain points were and one were their biggest priorities going into the new years, both in 2020 and 2021. And in both cases, the number one pain point was around identifying and attaching value and revenue to marketing tactics. And their number one priority was around attribution as well. And it's no secret that, marketing has become, as we talk about with Scott, a much more data-driven endeavor. And now it's really the onus is falling on the marketers to basically prove it. And especially in B2B, where you have these longer and complex sales cycles with multiple touch points and over the course of multiple months, it's really difficult, right? It's not an easy task. And so that's why everybody consistently is saying that that's really what they need to get their arms around.
Yeah, and I think it's just especially because it is both a priority and a pain point. The more information we as Serkin Research and people who are collecting data on that can share, the better. And so I wanted to make sure that we were able to let people know that we hear you. This is a problem that we know you are prioritizing and focusing on and will likely continue to. And we are doing our part to figure that out as well.
Exactly.
So another thing, totally switching gears, that I found very interesting is that Scott refers to the Nobel Prize winning quote, which as a quote person myself really stuck with me. And naturally, I had to look into it and find out more. So first and foremost, the quote that Scott mentioned was by chemist Linus Pauling, who was the only person to ever win two unshared Nobel Prizes, both in chemistry in 1954 and in peace in 1962. And then more specifically, the quote that Scott is referring to occurred in an exchange between Pauling and one of his students, where the student asked Pauling how he managed to have so many ideas, to which Pauling replied by saying the best way to have good ideas is to have a lot of ideas and throw away the bad ones.
It's such a great quote. And I think it helps because so many of us are, you know, we can't move forward until something feels perfect, until it feels right. And I think what that really speaks to so much is the idea that, now, we all, no matter what we are, we all have to throw a bunch of stuff at the wall. And if it's not plan A, you gotta have a plan B, and maybe it's plan C or plan D. And it will work, but it's not that the people that are geniuses just have all those ideas off the bat. So I love that one.
Yeah. And I think relating that to the workplace more specifically is, like, Jeff and I always talk about how it's so much easier to talk out your ideas as opposed to having them all just stuck in your brain. And so creating a space where you can share the good, the bad, and the ugly ideas and figure out which one of those is going to be the one you run with. And even if it's not what ends up being the quote unquote good idea, having a support system and a company culture where you can do that is so crucial as well to success beyond the chemistry field.
Yeah. And again, the logical extension of this, and we didn't really talk about this much with Scott, but is failing fast, right? So it's better to have, and what I always say is, we may not have all the right ideas, but we can know how we're going to test something. We can know how we're going to measure something, and we can know how we can do it in a bite-sized way, so that how quickly can we figure out whether or not this is the right idea? And then how can we set some guardrails to know how we switch gears and how we move forward? So we're not, you know, sort of stuck in this cycle of, well, I guess we'll find out after the fact, you know, a year or 2 years from now. We have, you know, ways of doing this in the short term that will help us. And failing fast is okay. And we try to do our best to celebrate that we had the idea we thought was good. We tried it. Maybe it didn't work. That's okay. And we move on. We have plan B. Well, thank you, Sophia. as always, all of the research and references can be found in our show notes. And if you want to reach out to us directly about this story or to inquire about sharing your own story with us, you can reach us at lsspodcast@circanresearch.com. Thank you for listening. We hope you'll join us for a new story next week on Long Story Short. I want to thank Circan Research for being the sponsor of our show. Circan Research fuels demand for B2B marketers looking to gain a competitive advantage. We leverage original research and data-driven content to supercharge your growth. You can find out more on our website at circanresearch.com.